Emitimos desde las instalaciones de radio en la Universidad de Guelph, en Ontario, Canadá, CFRU 93.3 FM, y para el mundo desde www.cfru.ca, y por nuestros blogs en mujeresporlademocracia.blogspot.com y alternativalatinoamericana.blogspot.com. Agradecemos, como cada sábado, la participación siempre solidaria de nuestros invitados. Se despiden de ustedes desde Colombia nuestros amigos y compañeros del colectivo Radicales Libres, Silvia Oviedo, Leandro Murillo y Luis Alberto Castaño. Desde Argentina, la querida poeta, periodista y escritora María Neder. Desde mi bello México, la amiga querida periodista maestra en estudios de género, Daniela Villegas. Desde esta cabina de radio, la queridísima Madeleine Speed, mi compañero Sergio Pochón y quien les habla, su amiga Hilda Venegas, deseándoles una noche de justicia social a nuestros pueblos. Que si el presente es de lucha, el futuro es nuestro. Buenas noches y hasta la próxima.
You're listening to Back in the USSR. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That, of course, was Georgi Spiridov with Time Forward. And I am Siegfried Berezov, and I do have an announcement to make at the beginning of the show here. As you, of course, all of you will know by now, there's a federal election that has just been called, and I will be running in this upcoming federal election. I myself will be running in this upcoming federal election for the Communist Party here in Guelph. And unfortunately, due to the rules that do exist here at CFRU 93.3 FM, and I believe in public radio in general, I will not be able to do this show for the duration of my candidacy. Which basically means, as soon as I officially become a candidate in the election, I can't do this show until that election is over. Which, of course, won't be until, I believe, October 19th. You know, so fortunately, I do have somebody who is willing to fill in for me. He's been on the show quite a few times. He's a very knowledgeable guy, and this is a very dedicated communist, for that matter. And that, of course, is Brendan Campisi, who I've interviewed on a number of occasions. I've talked to him about the Black Panther Party and the African-American liberation struggle. I've talked to him about the Soviet Union and books written about the Soviet Union and human rights in the Soviet Union, which is a book written by Al Szymanski, which both of us are very big fans of his. And, he's just all around, like, just a amazing, amazing guy. And I think he's probably more qualified than anyone to fill in for me on this show while I run this election. You know, and do all the things that I have to do. So hopefully he will be here, because, I mean, this could be the last show that I'm able to do. I mean, I could be announcing my candidacy as of next week. So this might be my last show until late October, for that matter. So hopefully we can get Brendan in as soon as possible to kind of keep things going, you know, an even flow on this show, so there really isn't kind of any interruptions, and we can kind of keep things going. But I really wanted to just let you know about all that sort of thing, because, of course, that's a pretty major announcement right there. So really, to kind of begin the show, and I guess get you more acquainted with some of the work he's done on this show in the past, I'm going to play an interview which he did with my friend Patrick. Of course, Patrick was the one who filled in for me while I was in China for an entire year, which is the last time, like, this show, I couldn't be here. And fortunately, I was able to get somebody else to kind of back me up on that and fill in. So the first time he was ever on the show was, of course, back then, and he did an interview about Gabriel Kolko's book. Gabriel Kolko is an amazing Marxist historian, and he did a book called The Politics of War. In that book, he talks about the reality of the situation that led to the Korean War, and it's very, very illuminating. And it's a history that most people do not have access to in society right now, and there's a lot of myths surrounding the Korean War and how it began and all this sort of stuff, and a lot of anti-communist propaganda that still definitely is like floats around, like, you know, things like the interview and the demonization of North Korea and stuff are any indication. So this is the first talk which he ever gave on back in the USSR. It was is from about, I guess this is about a year and a half ago or so, and this is where he's talking about this book, and he's really talking about the Korean Revolution, because there was a Korean Revolution, and it was actually very, very significant. So I'm going to play this this talk that Brendan Campisi gave, and I think it proves more than anything else what a knowledgeable guy he is, and how he's, you know, more than qualified to fill in for me on this show, you know, while I run in the election. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Okay, so we have Brendan Campisi here again to talk about The Politics of War and The Limits of Power by Kolko. So another topic he talks about is the transition in Korea. So what does he say about that?
All right. So the very first mention of Korea in The Politics of War, and the first point when Korea sort of gained any kind of attention in terms of global politics during this period, was in 1943, when at a conference of the great powers in Moscow, a very sort of vague and more or less perfunctory agreement was reached to take Korea into some kind of trusteeship after the war, after the Japanese had been defeated, and that it would be essentially run by one or all of the great powers. And the United States wanted that to last for as long as possible. They suggested 20 or 30 years. The Soviets didn't want to make any kind of firm commitment in terms of years, but what they were arguing was that it should be as brief as possible. The Soviets weren't pushing for, in terms of what was going to happen to former Axis colonies and even other European colonies, the Soviets at this point weren't pushing for immediate independence anywhere, mostly because they knew that the Western allied countries were just not going to get behind that, so there was no possible agreement that could be made on that basis. But they were always advocating for as limited a period of sort of foreign rule as they could get the Americans and the British to agree to, basically. So the situation in Korea, of course, was that it was occupied by the Japanese, and it had been since 1910. And it had been subjected to very, very brutal colonial rule. The vast majority of Koreans under Japanese rule were kept in low-paying, dangerous industrial work or were peasants. And many of the Korean landlord class were dispossessed, and the land was taken over by Japanese landowners. And there was a great deal of industrial development in Japanese-ruled Korea, but it was all to export to Japan. It was all determined by the economic priorities of Japan. And Koreans were subjected to a great deal of national oppression as well. They were forbidden from writing or publishing in their own language. They had to take Japanese names. And they were basically taught in the educational system that Korean culture was inferior and that you know, Japan was superior. So the situation of Koreans under the Japanese occupation was one of brutal economic exploitation and national oppression. So there was a very developed resistance movement in Japanese-occupied Korea. There were a number of sort of political tendencies in it, but mostly it was basically leftist. The Korean Communist Party had a very small presence on the ground in Korea, but they were an important force in the resistance nonetheless. And then there were also various Korean resistance groups in exile. There was a group led by Kim Il-sung that during the war was in the Soviet Union, but in the 1930s had been in Northern China fighting the Japanese alongside the communists. There was another group of Korean communists in southern China that was also fighting alongside Mao, fighting the Japanese. And then there were right-wing nationalist exiles in Western countries, mostly in the United States, and their main leader was Syngman Rhee, and of course Rhee and Kim Il-sung were the leading, eventually become the leading figures of post-war Korea in their respective Korean states. So in the war in Korea ends, or the Japanese occupation in Korea, I should say, ends in August 1945 when the Soviets defeat the Japanese. And at this point, the Korean people basically rise up. And Kalko describes Korea at this point as a very intensely politicized society. The resistance to Japan, again, had been a mass phenomenon, and there was this deep and broad underground organization among the Korean people. And as soon as the Japanese were gone, that became the government. Popular committees were organized in every city and town in Korea, and they started running the place, basically, everywhere where the Japanese military forces weren't still present, and they elected a national leader, or they elected sort of regional leaderships and national leaderships, and by late summer in 1945, they'd proclaimed the People's Republic of Korea, and there was a very clear political program that these popular committees were pushing for, and that the Korean masses were demanding, and that involved nationalizing all foreign-owned industry, which was basically industry in Korea, and land reform, and independence for the country. So there's a very clear social and national program that the Korean people were demanding. And at this point, At this point, the Americans enter southern Korea, because the Soviets had agreed during the war that even if they were the ones who actually militarily liberated all of Korea, there would be two occupation zones, one in the north that they would control, and then an American occupation zone in the south. And, you know, it might seem strange that the Soviets would agree to this when there were no Americans, at a point when there were no American soldiers on the ground in Korea, but you have to remember that they were mostly concerned with sort of with the international diplomatic level of their relations with the United States, not, you know, the situation on the ground in one tiny country that was, you know, strategically not very significant for anybody at this point, wasn't, you know, a primary consideration. So they made that agreement, and the Americans started taking over their occupation zone in the south. But the thing is, before the Americans had any troops on the ground in Korea, they tried to exert their control through the Japanese military that were still there. They were giving orders to the Japanese in Korea, and they were giving them orders to suppress demonstrations and not to allow this sort of this energy and this politicization of the Korean people to release itself in any kind of substantial way. There was an order given that when the Americans showed up, when the American troops arrived in Korea, there were to be no demonstrations even to welcome them. But there was. Not so much because people were happy to see the Americans, but because they were happy that their country was liberated from the Japanese. But there was this huge popular demonstration to welcome the American troops when they arrived. And the Americans ordered Japanese soldiers to fire on that demonstration, and a few people were killed. That, to me, I think, is a really sort of evocative moment of the post-war situation in Korea and the post-war situation in Asia. Because effectively, the Americans were willing to use, and the British and the French in their colonial possessions were willing to use the existing Japanese military forces that they'd just been fighting to crush nationalist movements and movements of the left. So that's the very, very beginning of the American occupation in South Korea. In North Korea, the Soviets found that the people had taken over, you know, the people had taken over the towns. They were running the towns and the cities, and they were running the factories, and, you know, basically a popular self-government existed already, and they simply decided to recognize it. And they handed over as much political power as they could to the popular committees, even while they were still militarily in control of the northern area of the country. So it's at this point, August and September 1945, that the fortunes of North and South Korea start to diverge. Because in the North, what happened was that this program that the Korean people were overwhelmingly and very clearly demanding started to be carried out. There was nationalization of all the existing industry, and Northern Korea actually had most of the industrial infrastructure of Korea under the Japanese, where South Korea had the majority, or Southern Korea, I suppose, had the majority of the population and of the agricultural productivity. So that industrial base was taken into social ownership, and there was a huge, huge program of land redistribution. The landlords in Northern Korea were given the option of staying as smallholding farmers, just like their former tenants, or of leaving. And the overwhelming majority of them went to South Korea. They simply, they couldn't conceive of being anything other than the ruling class. So essentially, in Northern Korea, 1945, a revolution is carried out by a popular and democratic government. That's the birth of North Korea, basically. And in South Korea, meanwhile, the situation is very, very different. Because while the masses in Southern Korea are pushing for this exact same program of demands of nationalization, of land reform, of democracy and independence for Korea, the American military government is in no way inclined to meet that program. Kalko makes the point that even compared to some of the other American occupation administrations in places like Germany or Japan, the Korean one was staffed overwhelmingly by extremely conservative military men, men with no democratic sensibility whatsoever, basically authoritarian sensibilities. And importantly, many of the American military leaders in Korea at this point saw war with the Soviet Union as imminent and felt that they were, logically, if that was going to happen, they were going to be on the front lines of the very, very shortly to arrive, war with the Soviet Union. So there was the political character of the American military government in South Korea was bitterly anti-communist and very conservative. And that sort of prejudged what sort of political forces they were going to be working with in Korea. The Americans had a bit of a problem in Korea, which is that most of the conservative forces that they would be willing to work with had actually collaborated with the Japanese. And so it would, you know, it would look bad. It would be bad public relations, if nothing else, if suddenly the new government that they were sponsoring was full of Japanese collaborators. Thankfully, there were nationalist forces on the right, forces that had not collaborated with the Japanese, again, led by Syngman Rhee. So they very quickly created a very, very prominent role for Rhee and for his followers. But at the level of local governments and the police and the military that they started to create, it was full of Japanese collaborators. When they arrived, they'd found in some areas of southern Korea, where the Japanese weren't still in control, a very similar situation to the ones the Soviets found, where the workers and peasants were simply running the towns and the villages, and land was being redistributed in a very orderly way, actually, and the industrial infrastructure was being run by the workers. And of course, in very sharp contrast to what the Soviets did, they made sure that all that property was taken back. If it was Japanese, they couldn't exactly give it back to its proper, or what they viewed as its proper owners. But if it was Korean, then they definitely tried to. And they actually took legal possession of a huge amount of land that had already been redistributed. And they took the land that had been under Japanese ownership, and they sold it, they just sold it on the open market with no kind of control whatsoever. So, as Kalko describes, most of it ends up in the hands of the existing landowning class or black marketeers and people who'd been able to get rich during the war off of the black market. There was also an enormous black market in southern Korea at this time that American soldiers were participating in, and that was, again, similarly to China, causing massive inflation and pushing people into poverty. And the American military government imposed wage controls, but not any kind of price controls. So the consequence of that was just to push the workers and peasants in southern Korea just deeper and deeper into poverty. And as a consequence, soon you have strikes and protests going on all over southern Korea at a very, very high level. Hundreds of thousands of people are going on strike and protesting. There was an incident where a railroad strike turned into a general strike, which was then repressed by the Americans at the cost of dozens of strikers being shot dead. And then that led to mass protests from other areas of the workforce and from students that they had to suppress. The Americans and the Korean police that they were creating had to suppress with enormous brutality. And very quickly, the American military government in South Korea came to regard any expression of dissent as simply communist and Russian-backed and just not to be dealt with in any other way but repression and force. And in that context, they had elections in southern Korea in the summer of 1946. And so these elections were an obvious fraud, basically. What they did was they held the elections in a number of levels so that, as one official who actually participated in this described, so that undesirables could be weeded out. And they limited the vote to household heads or the heads of 10 households. So essentially they were limiting the vote to men with some kind of position of authority in their communities. And at this point, much of the left in southern Korea, which had a mass base and mass support, was already being suppressed. People were already being thrown in prison or hiding in the mountains from right-wing and American repression. So in that context, the election was an obvious victory for the right. And while this is going on, the other great powers who wanted to have a say in Korea, they didn't want the Americans to be running the whole show, start complaining about this situation, especially the Soviets, who are concerned with the repression of the left in South Korea and sort of empowerment of forces that they understand are very, very hostile to communism and to the Soviet Union in South Korea. And the Americans just try to fob them off, basically, and sort of convince them they don't really need to have any kind of say in what goes on in Korea. But they try to come to an agreement with the Soviets about holding elections in both of the zones. But the Soviets insist on excluding political forces that have rejected previous agreements on the subject of Korea made by the United States and the Soviet Union, and on rejecting the inclusion of sort of political forces that are known to be anti-Soviet, which would exclude the forces that the Americans were supporting already. So they couldn't really come to any kind of agreement on elections in both zones. And at this point, the Americans come up with the idea of using the United Nations to, this is in 1946-47 we're talking about now, to legitimize elections that they're that they want to have in the southern zone in Korea anyway. So a UN commission is created to study the possibility of having an election in South Korea, having an election that would, at this point it was clear, lead to the creation of a new state. And on that commission are Canada, Australia, El Salvador, the Republic of China, so the Kuomintang, and the Philippines. So we have neocolonial American puppet states and a couple of Western countries that are very closely aligned to the United States, even if they're, you know, actually independent compared to the Philippines or El Salvador. But even this body very quickly realized that the situation in Korea is not one where any kind of free elections could be held, because when they go to South Korea, they're totally dependent on the military government and on the existing Korean administration that the Americans have set up to get around and to get any kind of information. They aren't able to visit, they discover they aren't able to visit many of the leaders of the left-wing parties to even talk to them, because they're either in prison or in hiding. So this UN commission very quickly realizes that there's no possibility of having a free election in the conditions of repression that that exists. It should be mentioned that it wasn't just the American military or the new Korean police that were repressing the left. The Americans had allowed right-wing parties to create militias, basically, including one that was explicitly and consciously modeled in the Hitler Youth. That was, I think, the one tied to Syngman Rhee's party, to terrorize the left. So in conditions of massive right-wing repression, the commission realizes they can't hold free elections. So the Canadian and Australian representatives say that they should just describe the situation as it is and say that they couldn't support holding elections. But the representatives from China and the Philippines and El Salvador, whose governments are, of course, much, much more dependent on the United States, say that they were given a task to legitimize these elections, and that's what they have to do. And eventually there's also a French representative, and eventually the French representative comes around to the position of the puppet states, and so the commission agrees. The Canadians and Australians, reluctantly but ultimately, they do agree to recommend that these elections be held and to stay in southern Korea and observe the elections when they are held. And the elections, when they're held, are essentially an even worse fraud than the elections that have been held earlier in 1946 for, I guess, at the more local level. Even there was a mass boycott of these elections. All the leftist parties were boycotting the elections, and even the nationalist right was boycotting these elections, because what everybody understood was that these elections were meant to lead to the creation of a separate state out of the American occupied zone of South Korea. And the nationalist right in Korea still wanted national unity. They didn't want to be limited. They didn't want Korea to be partitioned at this point. So even conservative forces that were nationalists and were opposed to partition boycotted these elections, and the left did. And in any case, the left was being suppressed and wouldn't have been able to campaign, or you know, people wouldn't have been able to vote for the left even if the left had been running. So the elections are boycotted by the vast majority of people in South Korea, and Syngman Rhee's party, the one force on the right that's most closely tied to the Americans, wins an overwhelming victory. And Kalko describes Syngman Rhee at this point as a Korean Chiang Kai-shek, basically leading a clique that's only able to stay in power because of American support, and that doesn't even represent the majority of conservative forces in Korean society. And the elections are also held in a context of deepening repression. There are protests against the elections, and in the week before, the week leading up to the election, 300 people are killed in repression across southern Korea. And the government in Pyongyang, in the north, first of all, told people in the south to vote, I mean, to boycott these elections, but they also attempted to organize their own national elections. So there were elections held in the northern zone at this point, but they also attempted to organize an underground election in the south as part of a national Korean election. Of course, it's difficult to organize an election in clandestinity, but there were some votes that they were able to do it to some extent. But basically, after it had happened, everyone in South Korea who'd participated in the northern elections essentially was rounded up and imprisoned. So, I mean, that's also a good indicator of the situation. So, by 1948, you have two. The situation is that you have two Korean states, and in one of them, in the northern one, the program of demands that the Korean people basically rose up behind in 1945 was being carried out, and in the other, because the Americans had been able to control the situation, an extraordinarily repressive, at this point, basically neo-colonial police state had been established. And that's the situation that, of course, leads up to the Korean War.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was the Red Army Choir with the Song of the Partisans. And that, of course, was just before that we had Brendan Campisi, who will be filling in for me as I when I go to run in the federal elections. He will be filling in for me on this show. And that was his talk which he gave about the situation that led up to the Korean War in the 1940s. And one of the things, I have talked about like history quite a few times and why on this show and why it is important to understand for those people who fight for radical change in society, why it is important for us to understand history and historical context. And this isn't just for, like, curiosity or nostalgia or anything like that. People who struggle for radical change today often make references to their future grandchildren. You especially hear this in the environmental movement, but you can also hear it in the labor movement and other movements as well. People trying to use the idea of a better future, you know, for their children or the grandchildren, to motivate the masses of the people to struggle against oppression and exploitation right now, in the here and now. You know, you've heard this line many times, and it doesn't work. And I'm going to give you a quote by a Marxist philosopher named Walter Benjamin that explains why this line of argument does not work. And he says this: "The subject of historical knowledge is the struggling oppressed class itself. Marx presents it as the last enslaved class, the avenger that completes the task of liberation in the name of generations of the downtrodden. This conviction, which had a brief resurgence in the Spartacus League, has always been objectionable to social democrats. Within 3 decades, they managed to erase the name of Blanqui almost entirely, though at the sound of that name, the preceding century had quaked. The social democrats preferred to cast the working class in the role of a redeemer of future generations, in this way cutting the sinews of its greatest strength. This indoctrination made the working class forget both its hatred and its spirit of sacrifice, for both are nourished by the image of enslaved ancestors rather than by the ideal of liberated grandchildren." You know, this is a point which I find the majority of the left, and I would say specifically the North American left, does not understand. And by the way, some of the reference points might be a little cryptic for a lot of people. His reference to Blanqui. Blanqui was actually Louis-Auguste Blanqui, to give his full name, was a revolutionary leader in France in the 19th century and spent most of his life in prison for his attempts to overthrow the government and enact a revolution in that country in the late 19th century. And definitely he inspired a lot of people at that time. And definitely put the fear of God into the ruling class at that time. And what he's saying in that quote is how these social democrats, particularly in Germany, but also in other countries as well, these leftist parties that are in the parliaments in those countries, the mainstream kind of left organizations in those countries, have chosen to ignore the history of working class struggle, of revolutionary struggle, in their own countries, and instead focus on this potential future, this better future, that they think might happen, you know, somewhere down the line. And they're going to use that vision of a future to motivate people to fight in the here and now. And he's saying that that is an immense mistake. That cuts the sinews of the working class's greatest strength, which is its understanding of history, its identification with previous generations of struggle. It's this revolutionary tradition, this tradition of class struggle, which they understand themselves as being a part of, and they take inspiration from, they take empowerment from. I mean, one of the main reasons why, say, African-American movements and struggles in recent years, including Black Lives Matter, have been so effective is because Black people know who they are, they know their own history, they know who has historically oppressed them, they know who the enemy is, and they are basically motivated by their historical experience. You know, Aboriginal movements like Idle No More are the same way. You know, just like Walter Benjamin says, they are motivated by an understanding of who they are in a historical context. You know, and who their enemies are in the present, as well as in the past. You know, they understand who they have to fight against. They understand who the enemy is. You know, they have no illusions, because they've learned from previous struggles. They have this past. They have this history, which they identify with. They believe in. They draw inspiration from. and they carry that forward. And this is far more powerful than any visions of liberated grandchildren or vague ideas of a better future ever could be. You know, sure, and of course they want a better future. I mean, all these movements definitely are fighting for a better future. But they view that better, they understand that that better future is not built out of thin air. You know, it has to be built on a strong foundation. It has to be rooted in a tradition of resistance, a tradition of struggle. And this is very important to understand if we want to be effective in pushing for a revolutionary transformation of society. It doesn't matter where it is. That transformation has to come out of a history of resistance, a history of movements against oppression and exploitation, a history of struggle. And we have to identify with that history and understand and be able to take it forward and understand there is a continuum of resistance that we can identify with, we can be a part of. You know, a history that has its heroes, people who inspire us, in some cases to make the ultimate sacrifice in the name of change, because sometimes that's necessary. You know, something we can identify with, something that prevents us from burning out when, you know, repression comes our way and when the odds seem stacked against us and when it looks like we're going nowhere. We still draw inspiration from those past struggles, those past heroes. We know who we are. We know what we fight for. And we won't surrender. That's really powerful because I see activists today, they're really, so many of them are on the verge of burnout. And largely this is because they don't have an understanding of history and an understanding of who they are. They don't have that. They don't have this foundation they can build upon. They don't have that understanding. So then it's like, you know, they're kind of in a void, you know. They don't know where to turn. You know, and that's a major weakness that has to be overcome. And it can only be overcome through the understanding of history and how history can empower struggles in the here and now. That's very, very crucial. And the thing is, like, in most parts of the world, that's well understood. That point is well understood. I mean, most parts of the world, when people rise up, when people fight, they have a very clear understanding of history and what it means to them and the fact that they're a part of something greater. And they're not just like looking towards a better future. They're also identifying with past generations and the struggles that they went through. And they're building on that history. They're building on that tradition. And that's crucial. So I'm going to play a song which really emphasizes that. This song is from Africa. And it's by a group called Facile Combat. And this group, really, this song really captures not only the tradition of resistance against colonialism in Africa, but also like goes beyond that, like to the African-American struggle and like struggle on different continents around the world of oppressed peoples fighting back. And just really grasp, if you can, like the understanding that these guys have and just how powerful it is. Their identification with past generations that have gone through these struggles and understanding that how that carries forward to them, how they are a part of that, and how they carry it forward. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
chose ne dure pas, les grands hommes aussi, qu'ils viennent de Durban ou du royaume aussi. Ce n'est pas un fait nouveau depuis l'époque du Messie. Les hommes trop lucides sont ciblés, génocide. Le système n'aime pas ceux qui ont un sixième sens, car ils sont supposés avoir un troisième œil. On ne fera pas le deuil de ceux qui ont osé dire au péril de leur vie, refuser de mentir au nom de la dignité de la masse. Oppression des menaces, tenir le même discours, ça ne coupe pas les rues. Les hommes de cette carrure, ces hommes qui bravent tout sans armes et sans armure. Imagine la Turquie sans Ankara, ça en dit long, n'est-ce pas, je pense à Sankara. Les cerveaux du continent sont victimes de mascarades, victimes de balances qui s'en masquent rôdent. Repose en paix, que la terre vous soit légère. Contrairement à ce qu'il voulait, bourreau vous immortalise. On priera pour vous dans les mosquées, dans les églises. Je poursuis mon listing, Che Guevara, Gandhi, Luther King. Dans nos mémoires resteront toujours gravés comme Mandela, Malcolm X ou Marcus Garvey. À cette allure, le continent ne peut que sombrer, car ces militants sont tous en train de crever.
Yamlogaduni.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Facile Combat with the song Martyrs. And that song was actually, they're from Burkina Faso, actually, that particular band. And you see, like, in that song, like, they name people like the revolutionary leader of Burkina Faso in the 1980s, Thomas Sankara. They name Malcolm X. They name Marcus Garvey. They name, you know, Nelson Mandela and all these other, you know, heroes of liberation struggles, like not only in Africa but also in African Americans as well. And these are the people I identify with. You know, they understand this is there's entire tradition of revolutionary struggles, and they're like singing about this. They're putting this into words, and it's very, very powerful. And it's this kind of stuff that, of course, inspires current movements. I mean, recently the entire government, in fact, like in this just happened like earlier this year, the government of Burkina Faso, the basically the neo-colonial government, which has been in place since the revolutionary government in Burkina Faso was overthrown in the late 1980s, that neo-colonial government was overthrown by a popular uprising. And they were inspired by the image, by the example of the of Thomas Sankara and the revolutionary movement that he led in Burkina Faso in the 1980s. So these people have a keen understanding of history. You know, they understand, like, you know, they understand what came before them. They identify with what came before them. And they take that as a strength, you know, like they allow that to give them strength as they fight against oppression in the here and now. You know, and that's what I'm talking about with the real value of history and how empowering it really is. You know, when you understand you're a part of something greater. Like, one of the things that really I find undermines, maybe even cripples, I would say even cripples, like, the a lot of labor struggles in the West is the fact, like, you know, is anti-communism. You know, they feel they cannot afford to identify with communism. Or in a lot of cases, with socialism, even. You know, they can't afford to identify with these things because they think that's going to turn people off. It's going to, like, you know, people in power won't listen to them. They won't get any support. They, you know, they from the mainstream or any of that sort of stuff. And they have to distance themselves from that entire tradition of struggle led by communists. They have to distance themselves from communist countries. You know, they can't identify with those things. They can't identify with revolutionary struggles anywhere in the world. I mean, they can't identify with these things. This entire, this huge, huge history out there, they have to cut themselves off from. Because they think if they don't cut themselves off from that, they won't have any legitimacy. You know, and that's terrible. That's terrifying. Because if they do cut themselves off from that, what do they have left? Frankly, not much. They lose most of their tradition. You know, I mean, even the struggle for trade unions in this country, in Canada, in the 1930s and stuff, most of that was led by communists. So if you cut yourselves off from communism, you're cutting yourself off from yourself as a labor activist, as a labor union in Canada today. And yet that's what so many of them have done. You know, so you're cutting yourself off from this thing that is really going to empower you, really going to give you hope, going to keep, you know, make you keep fighting, understanding the victories that can be won if you fight effectively. You know, it cuts yourself off from all the heroes of that movement. You know, in the past, you know, like who fought for these things, like in the 1930s and 40s and this sort of stuff, who were radical and who were, you know, willing to go to the wall for what they believed in. You know, for the rights of working people. You know, you cut yourself off from that. You know, and all these things, it just weakens your ability to fight struggles and, you know, to win. It reduces your sustainability of those struggles. It, you know, it means they don't have the depth, they don't have the ability to inspire, they don't have, like, the ability to really mass mobilize, and, you know, they just generally shoot themselves in the foot because they cut themselves off from that. History matters. History matters in a big way, especially when you're trying to, like, do something like, you know, fight against the ruling class. If you're trying to fight against the ruling class, I mean, you know, you have to have something you can cleave to because you're going to be facing some tough times. You're going to have to identify with a tradition of struggle. Understand you're a part of something greater. Otherwise, you know, you're going to burn out. You know, you're going to collapse. So that's one of the reasons why, like, this is so important to talk about. And speaking about identifying with the history of, you know, with communist history, for example, in recent weeks, I interviewed Joshua Tartakovsky, an independent journalist who was in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine, and with the people who are fighting, the resistance movements that are fighting against the fascist government in Ukraine right now. and he was with those movements, and he saw how they, these anti-fascist resistance fighters, were they were identifying with the Soviet Union and the struggle that the Soviet Union waged against Hitler in the 1940s, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, and the whole resistance against fascism that that happened after that, which ultimately led to the destruction of the Third Reich itself, as the Soviet army, you know, pushed into Eastern Europe all the way to Berlin. You know, people who are fighting against fascism in Ukraine today identify with that struggle. They identify. They see themselves in that struggle. They see this as a continuation of that struggle. And they, and this gives them immense strength. Even when they're, like, facing up to massive firepower, massive repression, you know, horrific things. I mean, he detailed the kind of torture that was, that's meted out on captured partisans by the Ukrainian government. You know, it's horrific. You know, it's horrific stuff. You know, because so many of the fighters who are, the people who are fighting in the Ukrainian army now, they're outright fascists. They're, they outright, you know, admire Hitler. They admire, they already admire his methods, you know, all that stuff. You know, and they're brutal, brutal people who are willing to inflict the most horrendous crimes and tortures imaginable on their own countrymen. You know, and this is what the anti-fascist fighters in Ukraine, who include also international volunteers, are up against. You know, and in that struggle, they take inspiration from the Soviet struggle against Nazi Germany. They take it, they take inspiration from the anti-fascist struggle in Spain in the 1930s, in the Spanish Civil War, with the international brigades. And a lot of the international volunteers who go to fight in the Donbass, they hearken back to the international brigades as their inspiration. So once again, you see how history can, like, you know, past examples can inspire struggles today and here and now, and how powerful that can be. And this is very important to keep in mind. So I think what I'm going to do now is I'm going to actually play, I'm going to play the interview that Joshua did here on Back in the USSR once again. I mean, I think this is the only second time I've actually played it. And just, yeah, just keep those things in mind as you listen to the interview. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. So, okay, so you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And one of the stories which I have been talking about on the show quite a few times, actually, over the course of the past few years, of course, is the conflict in Ukraine, you know, with the Ukrainian government besieging the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine. So today on the show, I actually have the privilege of talking to somebody who has recently been to Donetsk, Donetsk People's Republic in eastern Ukraine, and kind of experience what things are like right there. So I'm going to be talking to Joshua Tartakovsky, right? Is that how you pronounce your
name? Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's good. And it's good to have you on the show.
Good to be on the show, Chris.
Okay, so basically where I want, and maybe you could just tell people when you were actually in Donetsk.
I visited Donetsk for several days towards the end of April in a trip organized by Europa Objective. Europa Objective, whose goal is to, it's a German Russian civilian initiative whose goal is to introduce journalists, bloggers, and people of interest to the region, so they take them to the Donetsk and explore the area.
Okay, so for those listeners who haven't been following the situation in Ukraine, maybe you could give a just an overview of the conflict and how it began.
Okay, so this whole Ukraine crisis has been going on for the past, right now we're in June, and there was the coup in Kiev was in April, but there were protests even before then. So for the past almost a year and 4 months, even not nearly, even a year and a half, but it's been going on for quite some time. I would say events began, the general impression people had of when events were beginning were in the months of early 2014, were protesters in Kiev, many of them with different civil groups with fairly decent intentions, were calling for the Ukraine to join the European Union and for Yanukovych to President Yanukovych to step down. Now, the thing is, of course, it is fair to criticize President Yanukovych, and for whatever reason, and at the same time, the demands of the protests at the time could have very well been legitimate. However, there's two points to remember about this issue. The first thing is that the U.S. was heavily involved in supporting this mobilization, but it also...